This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before most Americans had ever heard the word Taliban, journalist Ahmed Rashid wrote a book called Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil, and Fundamentalism in Central Asia. After September 11th and the war in Afghanistan, the book became a bestseller. In 2002, he wrote the book Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. Rashid lives in Lahore, Pakistan, and covers his country, Afghanistan, and Central Asia for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the Daily Telegraph of London. Ever since the publication of his book Taliban in 2000, we've been checking in with him occasionally to get his take on what's happening in his part of the world. Ahmed Rashid, welcome back to Fresh Air. You know, the last time we spoke was just before the U.S. invaded Iraq. Now we're speaking just before the election in Iraq. Could you describe the range of reaction you're seeing in Pakistan and in Afghanistan if you were recently there?
Well, I think there's a lot of despair about the situation in Iraq, and I think it's galvanizing anti-American opinion in the wider Muslim world, particularly in Pakistan and even in Afghanistan. A lot of what we talked about before the invasion, I think, unfortunately, has come to bear fruit in the sense that Iraq has become the center of Islamic extremism, the ethnic equation, the sectarian equation in Iraq has not been properly tackled by the Americans, you know, and all the rest of it. So I think the reactions in the wider Muslim world are very, very negative. And I don't think that these elections are necessarily going to be a panacea or give the U.S. a potential exit point.
Why don't you think the elections will improve the situation?
Well, I think there are going to be only partial elections. I think you will see large chunks of the Sunnis and in the Sunni triangle, people really not being either not voting or not being allowed to vote by the extremists. And there is now, with this huge presence of Al-Qaeda and al-Zarqawi, really calling for the murder of all Shias in Iraq. This is a very, very dangerous sectarian divide that is escalating day by day. A lot of today's victims over the last few weeks of the bombings in Baghdad and other areas have been Shias. And I think this is something that's overlooked. It's not just the political division, it's the sectarian divide which is growing in Iraq and for which obviously an occupying power does not have any real answers to.
The Bush administration has said that if we're fighting the terrorists in Iraq so that we don't have to fight the terrorists in the United States, I'm wondering, you've been following some of the terrorist groups for years. What impact do you think the war in Iraq has had on the recruiting into terrorist groups?
I think it's had a huge impact. First of all, for Iraq itself, I mean, you have the case now of many, many nationalities, not just Arabs, but, for example, seven Pakistanis have been recently killed fighting with the extremists in Fallujah. They belong to the Lashkar-e-Tayyiba group, one of the major militant extremist groups in Pakistan. So you have the phenomenon of, and clearly there are many more Pakistanis there, Afghans perhaps, people from Southeast Asia. Iraq itself has become a magnet. I mean, you know, it's being advertised as the easiest place to come and kill Americans.
Wait, I'm going to stop you when you say it's advertised. Is that what are you referring to?
Well, in the local underground of extremism, on the websites, in the kind of inspirational talk given in some of the more extremist mosques and madrasas, that is religious schools, that is how it's being advertised. If you want to really kill the infidel, well, there is no better place to do it in Iraq. It's a major recruiting kind of slogan, if you like.
Well, the picture that you're painting is not one of a victory over the terrorists.
No, not at all. I mean, I think the American-led war on terrorism, you know, ever since the Americans went into Iraq, has been a failure. They took the eye off Afghanistan. They moved all their resources to Iraq for nearly 2 years. They virtually ignored the Afghanistan and the Pakistan-Afghanistan border region, where a lot of these al-Qaeda people were based. And they created, the Bush administration created a whole round of complex difficulties for themselves in the Muslim world. If you know, Muslim regimes, whether they be tyrants or dictators or even elected leaders, wanted to cooperate with the United States after 9/11 and after the war in Afghanistan ended, they found it much more difficult to cooperate with the US on intelligence, on counterterrorism, on all these issues once the US invaded Iraq, because there was just no international consensus on Iraq. And in the light of this, you know, extremism has flourished. I think one of the other very, very big negatives as a Muslim and being living in the Muslim world, there was a debate that started after 9/11 that, you know, the Muslim world needs to reform. We need to relook at ourselves. We need to condemn this extremism much more strongly, etc., etc. And that debate was just killed after Iraq, because, you know, no Muslim could stand up and talk about, you know, modernization and reform and democracy, because you were just shouted down and said, you know, you're an American agent or a Western agent. I mean, look what the Americans are doing in Iraq. So I think, you know, on so many fronts, at least in the Muslim world, Iraq has resulted in a failure of what I would call the more important strategy, one of countering Islamic extremism, which after all is not an American effort. It has to be a global effort. And secondly, of trying to promote some kind of genuine reform in the Muslim world.
I'm wondering what kind of impact the recent Seymour Hersh article in The New Yorker had. And this is the article about how the Bush administration is considering bombing Iran to take out their nuclear weapons sites.
I can tell you, in Pakistan, it's created enormous waves and enormous trepidation and enormous fears. And despite the denials by Washington, and, you know, it is bound to create even more anti-Americanism, make it much more difficult for even the allies of the United States in the Muslim world to support the Muslim world. For example, President Musharraf, the military ruler in Pakistan, is an ally of the U.S., but I think he has already denied that Pakistan is involved in helping the Americans. He will also have to publicly come out very strongly, I think, in the next few days or weeks against any such use of force in Iran. Iran is a neighbor of Pakistan. It's one of the biggest Muslim powers, although it has differences with Arabs and with Pakistan. I think you'll see all the Muslim countries advocating very strongly any such use of force against Iran. You then have the prospect, I mean, you then have other fallouts. You have Shias, because Iran is predominantly Shia Muslim. The Shia minorities around the world will, particularly in the Middle East, in Pakistan, will react extremely angrily. If God forbid, I mean, the Americans do attack Iran, you may well get a wave of Shia terrorism, if you like, or Shia extremism directed at the Americans, which so far we really haven't had. You know, what you are seeing is Sunni extremism. You're not seeing Shia extremism. The other potential fallout is that you might get a common platform by both Sunnis and Shias condemning this. So, for example, someone like Musharraf could be in big trouble, because you may get the Sunni parties in Pakistan and the Shia parties uniting in condemning the Americans and condemning Musharraf for being an ally of the Americans. And I think this could well be repeated across places like North Africa. I think this would create even tensions in Saudi Arabia and Arab countries who have huge difficulties with Iran, but where there would be enormous sympathy for another Muslim country being attacked by the Americans.
You said that you think a lot of the Muslim countries will be very opposed to any American intervention in Iran. Now, many Muslim countries are very opposed to American intervention in Iraq. That did not stop America from intervening in Iraq. Do you think that the strategy would be any different this time around, if there is a this time around?
You know, Iran is viewed much more differently. I mean, the failure of the fundamentalist parties across the Muslim world to galvanize support in favor of Saddam Hussein, of course, fell flat because Saddam was who he was. I mean, he was a tyrant and, you know, he killed more Muslims than almost anyone else. So I think, you know, most people accepted that. That is not the case with Iran. I mean, Iran is considered a legitimate government. Probably most Muslims would argue it has a legitimate reason to acquire nuclear weapons. It has taken a very strong stand against Israel, which has pleased not just radical Muslims, but even many moderate Muslims. I think, you know, the main thing is that, you know, the way that Iraq and Saddam was demonized by the Americans. I mean, you can't demonize Iran to that extent. I mean, the neoconservatives might be able to demonize Iran for their constituency in the United States, but they will utterly fail to demonize Iran in the eyes of Muslims.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ahmed Rashid, and he reports on Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the Daily Telegraph of London. He's also the author of the bestseller Taliban and of the book Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. How much awareness is there in Pakistan, where you're based, of the so-called culture wars in the United States?
There's a lot of there's a lot of anger and anguish about what is seen as a very right-wing Christian evangelical Bush and the power that the right wing, especially the Christian right wing, is going to have, potentially have over this administration. Now, I think there's a lot of rumor and innuendo, and it certainly suits some of the extremist groups to kind of, you know, push this line. But for example, I mean, given we've been through all these rumors after 9/11, if you remember the big speculation after 9/11 in many parts of the Muslim world was that Israel had carried out the 9/11 bombing. And in fact, all the Jews had been told not to, who worked in the World Trade Center, not to go to work that day. Well, I mean, those kinds of absurd rumors are now being extended to the fact that, for example, the American military is trying to turn, you know, Muslims into Christians in Iraq. You've had stories about these Christian evangelical groups trying to convert victims of the tsunami in Indonesia and Sri Lanka. Now, all these kinds of things are picked up and magnified enormously, even though it might be, you know, I'm sure these evangelical groups are probably 1/50th of the aid that and the NGOs that are working in Southeast Asia. But this kind of news is magnified and picked up enormously. And certainly, you know, there is a sense that, you know, part of the neocon agenda in the Muslim world is to carry out proselytization and evangelism and, you know, try and undermine Islam.
That's interesting because, another criticism of the neoconservatives is it's some kind of like Jewish thing to help Israel, because some of the neoconservatives, like Paul Wolfowitz and Bill Kristol, are Jewish. So it's like they're getting it from both ends, Christian evangelizing and being Jewish.
Yeah, but I think after this election and the results of these elections, I think the neocon kind of link with Israel, etc., is being perhaps overtaken by the evangelical idea. Well, the idea that the Bush heartland is basically an evangelical Christian. And, you know, in the local media, we haven't heard much about it. We heard a lot about this links to Israel by the neocons, I think, in the aftermath of 9/11 and just before the Iraq war. I think it's subsided to some extent now. But what is very hot is now this idea that, America wants to Christianize the whole world.
My guest is journalist Ahmed Rashid. He covers Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the Daily Telegraph of London. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ahmed Rashid, and he reports on Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the Daily Telegraph of London. His books include the bestseller Taliban and Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. You've covered Afghanistan for more than 20 years. Your book Taliban was a bestseller. What was it like for you to witness the elections in October?
Oh, it was absolutely exhilarating. I was petrified, like everyone else, that, you know, given the security scare and the threats from the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, that nobody would turn up. But, you know, people, I mean, 70% of the population turned out to vote. I mean, it was such a moving experience. I had tears in my eyes, you know. I was out at 6 o'clock in the morning, and there were people lining up 2 hours before even the polling stations opened. And you went to the polling stations and you saw, I mean, people, although, you know, some of the staff there had been trained by the United Nations, etc. But, you know, a lot of them had no clue as to how, where to put all this materials they had, how to do it all. And, you know, they were kind of learning on the job. And it was just an incredibly heartening experience. And then, of course, the fact that, you know, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda failed miserably to carry out any acts of violence on election day and in the aftermath. So I think, you know, the elections really did. It was really the result, I think, of a population who are sick and tired of war, who want to see stability, and, you know, who want to go through a process where governments come and go, not through the gun, but through through the ballot box. And for all of them, it was a very new experience.
Would you describe a scene that sticks in your mind?
Well, particularly, I mean, visiting women's polling stations, you know, women going in to vote, many of them uneducated, many of them not having left the house, you know, for any other reason except to see relatives, coming into this polling station, having to line up separately from men, but then having to enter the polling station with hundreds of women milling around. And the fact that they all kind of realize that at this given moment, on this given day, women all over Afghanistan were doing exactly the same thing as they were doing. And this kind of made them, I think, very much aware of, you know, what a nation state means, I mean, in the modern era, given that Afghanistan, you know, has been not a nation state or a failed state for the last 20 years. It was just being, I think for them, for a lot of them, it was just being able to connect that, you know, hundreds and hundreds and thousands of women around the country are voting precisely at this time, you know, with me. And I think for them, it was a very, very important experience.
Well, you've described the elections in Afghanistan as being a very moving experience for you to witness. Do you think this is an example where American intervention did good?
Yes, I mean, I think there was no way that the Taliban would have been dislodged if there had not been an American intervention. And I think, you know, it's the invasion of Afghanistan was something very different from Iraq. I mean, it was, first of all, it was an act of self-defense, as far as the United States was concerned, after the 9/11 bombings. It was the liberation of a country. It was the overthrow of a despotic regime, which the Afghans didn't want, and hardly any of the neighbors wanted either. It was a very popular move. And again, one can be very critical of the follow-up, the lack of reconstruction, the lack of money committed, the diversion that Iraq took everyone's eyes and focus away from Afghanistan, etc., etc. But I think the dislodging of the Taliban and the crackdown on Al-Qaeda would never have begun unless that war had taken place.
When you're in Afghanistan, do you see any former Taliban leaders in the streets?
No, you don't. I mean, the hardline Taliban leaders who are opposing President Hamid Karzai are basically living in Pakistan. There are some Taliban who've come back and are with the regime, but they're being kept under sort of a kind of house arrest, if you like, because there's a danger that either they'll be killed by their former colleagues or by Al-Qaeda. And Karzai and the Americans are now trying to work on a plan for an amnesty for the majority of rank-and-file Taliban who are living as refugees in Pakistan to come back and take part in normal life. We haven't seen any major figures coming back yet or any large numbers of families coming back yet. But this is the plan. And I think it'll work because I think, you know, even amongst the Taliban, there's a very small minority who are actually doing the fighting, who are trying to kill American troops or disrupt the reconstruction process. The bulk of them, and here we would be talking about maybe, you know, 30, 40,000 men, young men, are living in refugee camps or living in religious schools in Pakistan, living very boring lives, wanting to go back to their villages, to their farms, not wanting to fight, having suffered a lot. But there is still a hardcore, which is still fighting back.
How much power do the warlords in Afghanistan have now? Are they a part of the government at all? Do they have control of certain areas in spite of not being part of the government?
It's much reduced. I mean, I think what we're seeing since the elections is the cabinet that has been chosen. There's only one warlord in the cabinet, a former warlord. Disarmament is taking place of these warlord militias now at a much faster pace than before. This is all because the election has, in a sense, legitimized Karzai, made him much stronger. He has got rid of several warlords completely. He's just sacked them from their jobs. And consequently, you know, their militias have just kind of dwindled and disappeared. So I think the last big, you know, hurdle is going to be the connection between this explosion in drugs production, heroin production, and the connection with the warlords. The fact is that a lot of these warlords are still surviving off drugs trafficking. If you can deal with the drug situation, then, you know, you will have also dealt in a very, very decisive way, I think, against warlordism.
Ahmad Rashid is a journalist based in Pakistan. His books include the bestseller Taliban and Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Pakistani-based journalist Ahmad Rashid. He covers his country, Afghanistan, and Central Asia for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the Daily Telegraph of London. His books include the bestseller Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil, and Fundamentalism in Central Asia. We've spoken several times on Fresh Air over the past few years, but we've never really gotten around to talking about you. So I'd like to just ask you a little bit about yourself, if you didn't mind. You were born in 1948 in Rawalpindi, which is part of Pakistan. But 1948 was the year that Pakistan was created. So were you born just at the time of the country's creation?
No, Pakistan was created in August 1947. I was born just 9 months after partition, what was then the partition of the Indian subcontinent into Pakistan and India. I was born there. I lived there. My parents moved to England in the mid-50s, and my father was an engineer. I came with them to England, although we kept going back to Pakistan a lot, and lived in England off and on for about 10 years, then went back to Pakistan and did another few years of education, and eventually went to Cambridge University in England to get a degree.
Why did you become a journalist?
Well, actually, it was a complete accident. I had set out to try and do a PhD on tribalism, and really, I drifted a lot for about a decade or so, and eventually, when I got down to it, I happened to be in Afghanistan when the Soviets invaded. The communist coup took place in April 1978. And I was looking at the tribes then and trying to understand what was going on amongst the tribes at that time, purely from an academic point of view. And then, you know, I came back to Pakistan and I went in again. And when I was in Pakistan, you know, friends got in touch with me in London and said, you know, what's going on in Afghanistan? Nobody's got a clue. We don't know who these guys are. And these communists, are they really communists? And I started writing. And then I, you know, happened to be back in Afghanistan when the Soviets invaded. So I, you know, phoned again the newspapers in London, and they just wanted, you know, anything I could provide. So it really took off purely by accident.
Have you ever been arrested or censored because of a story?
Oh, yes. I mean, I was picked up by the communists in Afghanistan, you know, after the Russian invasion several times. It was very funny. Right after the Russians invaded, I was arrested, and I was interrogated by this very smooth-talking Afghan KGB-trained guy called Najibullah, who I didn't know and who was obviously very clue. He spoke Urdu and English. He was multilingual. I was interrogated by him as to what I was doing. And anyway, I was released, and I was not handed over to the Russians, thank God, but I was released. And of course, the same Najibullah then became president. 5 years later. And well, the first time I interviewed him, I went to him and after the interview, I asked him, I said, do you remember who I am? And then I reminded him and I said, do you remember we had this, you interrogated me, but then we had this long conversation about tribalism in Pakistan. And he was absolutely taken aback, you know, and then he apologized profusely and all the rest of it. But yes, and then in Pakistan, I've been, you know, arrested during the Zia-ul-Haq period quite a lot. I was censored. I was told not to write. I continued writing under a pen name, pseudonym. And so this went on for 3 or 4 months, and then I started writing under my own name again.
Your book, Taliban, which you wrote before most Americans had even heard the word, became a bestseller. And with 25% of the royalties from that book, you started a fund to give grants to newly starting independent print media in Afghanistan. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, you know, I had benefited so much from Afghanistan, in a sense, you know, made my career, if you like. I had many friends there who, you know, wanted to be journalists. I had interpreters and translators and drivers and people who'd assisted me and people who were friends, I mean, intellectuals and academics who just lost everything. And, I felt very responsible that after the success of this book, I think I should try and put something back into the country. So I put, Open Media Fund started. It's doing very well. It's still, you know, it's in its third year now. We're funding something like 15 magazines and newspapers around the country, all types, political, cultural, women's issue magazines, in 3-4 different languages. And as society develops, presumably, you know, there's been a huge flurry of the media. I mean, in Kabul, there's something like over 100 newspapers and magazines, which is, you know, a lot of them are shoestring operations, but it's been quite extraordinary. There are several, radio has flourished, there are several TV channels now operating. Media, there's a real thirst and hunger for media.
Are there any press restrictions in Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, there is a press law, and essentially it's that you cannot, you know, defile the Prophet or Islam. You cannot talk, against Islam, as it were, which is, you know, in most countries. I think there's a lot of self-censorship because the fact is that some of these warlords still occupy very powerful positions and have the capability of retaliating against journalists and broadcasters. So I think there's censorship. Some people are pushing the envelope hugely. For example, some of the publications we have funded are naming warlords as being connected to the drugs trade and things like that. But generally speaking, there's a kind of self-censorship about what issues you can touch or not touch.
Well, Ahmed Rashid, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ahmed Rashid is a journalist based in Pakistan.